NATO marks 70 years this week. President Trump has been highly critical of the alliance. And now France's President Emmanuel Macron says we are watching the brain death of NATO.
Macron is telling the allies, well, we have to adjust to this new American posture. We have to take care of our security by ourselves.
Also this hour, we're heading to Ukraine and Chile and to England, where the Apostrophe Protection Society is throwing in the towel.
Mr. Richards has agonized over apostrophes for nearly two decades.
Mr. Richards may have lost the war, but he couldn't resist a parting shot toward the apostrophe haters.
I think it's a mixture of ignorance and laziness. They're too ignorant to know where it goes. They're too lazy to learn.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Today was supposed to be a day for Brits to put aside political differences and come together for a day of mourning. Vigils were held in London and Cambridge to remember the two victims of Friday's stabbing attack on London Bridge. The suspect was shot dead by police at the scene. He had been on early release from prison, where he was serving time for terrorist-related offenses. And that's what made today's day of mourning also a day of politics. In less than 2 weeks, there's a big election in the UK, and Friday's terror attack quickly became part of the campaign. Here's The World's Orla Barry in London.
There's nothing like a national tragedy to get people to set politics aside. And that's just what happened in the hours after the deadly attack at London Bridge last Friday. British politicians across the political spectrum put on a united front in the face of this terrible act of violence. On Friday night, all political parties agreed to suspend campaigning in advance of the general election. That agreement lasted about 10 hours. By Sunday morning, there was no holding back.
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's repulsive that individuals as dangerous as this man should be allowed out after serving only 8 years. And that's why we are going to change the law.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson went on to blame the early release of Usman Khan, the London Bridge attacker, on the opposition Labour Party in a testy exchange with the BBC's Andrew Marr.
This individual should have been in prison because of changes to the law that were brought in by the Labour Party that I voted against.
You're in power for 10 years and you've done nothing about it in 10 years.
That Jeremy Corbyn voted in favour of.
For 10 years you've done nothing about it.
In favour of automatic early release.
For 10 years you've done nothing about it.
You cannot retrospectively change the basis on which...
For 10 years you have done nothing about it.
The government's Home Secretary, Priti Patel, joined in with more criticism, writing in a Sunday newspaper that Labour didn't have what it takes to make important decisions about British security. Today, Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn hit back. He blamed cutbacks in public services by the Conservative government for creating a situation where people like Usman Khan become radicalised.
When those public services are cut back, as they have been during the past decade of austerity, they leave behind huge gaps. And that can lead to missed chances to intervene in the lives of people who go on to commit absolutely inexcusable acts.
The speed with which Boris Johnson laid the blame for Friday's attack at the door of the Labour Party may seem distasteful to some British voters, but it's likely that Johnson remembers what happened to his predecessor, Theresa May, in 2017. 3 weeks before the last UK general election, a suicide bomber killed 22 people at a concert in the city of Manchester. 2 weeks later, 8 people died during a terror attack, also at London Bridge. Labour was quick to blame the Conservatives for cutting police spending and weakening UK security. And the election that followed turned into a humiliating defeat for May, who lost her Conservative majority in Parliament. For the families of the victims, though, the political fight over Friday's attack seems deeply insensitive. David Merritt, whose son Jack was one of 2 people killed at London Bridge, tweeted a message that said, "Don't use my son's death to promote your vile propaganda." Today, at a vigil for the victims of the attack, political rivals came together again, but only briefly. Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn stood side by side in silence. It was up to the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, to try and rise above the political fray.
We come together this morning in condolences, but also in a spirit of defiance, to say that London will never be cowed or intimidated by terrorism, and also to commit to honouring the memory of Saskia and Jack, by dedicating our future to one not defined by hatred, but one defined by hope, by unity, and by love.
A couple of hours after that, Boris Johnson was back, talking about the length of prison sentences as an election issue. For The World, Orla Barry, London.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization turned 70 in 2019, so this week at their annual meeting in London, leaders from NATO countries will be marking the anniversary. It is a time for celebration and concern. President Trump has been badgering alliance partners for years about paying more in defense spending. Now French President Emmanuel Macron is raising more existential questions about the value and purpose of NATO in 2019. He wants Europe to look after more of its own security, compromise with Russia, and refocus NATO on fighting terrorism. Gérard Araud was the French ambassador to the U.S. from 2014 until this past June. He joins us from Paris. President Emmanuel Macron says NATO is brain dead. Help us understand what you think he means.
Well, you know, there has been a recurring debate about what is the use of NATO after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we understand that for a lot of our allies, Russia is still a threat. But it's not a global threat. It's not an existential threat. And it's difficult to say that we have NATO only against Russia, especially in the South. And that's an ongoing debate between the South and the East. In the South, NATO countries are really feeling the heat coming from the South, be Syria or be Libya or be terrorism. So in a sense, it's a wake-up call by Macron telling the allies, well, wait a minute. We should take care of all the threats that Europe is facing.
Last week at a press conference in Paris alongside NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, President Macron said NATO must focus on big strategic questions at this summit. What is Macron's vision for NATO?
Well, you know, what is striking today is not that the U.S. are leaving NATO or the military guarantee of the U.S. is not something that we can rely on. It's simply that the U.S. and with Obama and Trump is telling us we are not going to be the policeman of the world. And all the threats, the European threats, are on the periphery of Europe, be in Ukraine, in Syria, or in Libya, where the Americans don't want to act. So in a sense, for Macron, Macron is telling the allies, really, we have to adjust to this new American posture. We have to take care of our security by ourselves.
Is Emmanuel Macron pro-Russia?
It doesn't make sense, you know, really to say pro-Russia. It's simply to say Russia is there. We don't like its policy, but diplomacy is talking to our enemies, our adversaries. So we have to talk to Russia and to try to see whether a compromise is possible with Russia.
Gérard Araud, former ambassador from France to the United States, speaking with us from Paris. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ivo Dalder also holds the rank of ambassador. He was the American ambassador to NATO under President Obama. Ivo Dalder, President Macron says he wants NATO to re-envision itself and refocus its priorities on real existential threats like ISIS, not Russia. Do you agree?
Well, I think NATO has reprioritized its threats since the end of the Cold War. Clearly, Russia isn't the same kind of threat that the Soviet Union was during the Cold War, but it is still a significant political and indeed military challenge. In Ukraine, it has invaded a country, annexed part of it. It has large military forces that it exercises on NATO's borders. And of course, it retains a large nuclear arsenal that is pointed at Europe and at the United States.
Well, a central pillar for the French, as we just heard, is to try to find some compromise with Russia. How would that work? Does that seem reasonable to you?
Well, I don't have a problem with NATO, the United States, France, individual countries, and collectively engaging with Russia. As Ambassador Araud said, you talk to your enemies and to your adversaries, not just to your friends. So that makes eminent sense. But I'm not sure what the deal is that we're trying to achieve. If the deal is a deal with Russia that leads to the dissolution of NATO, it's not a deal that any other country is going to sign up to. Certainly not the United States, certainly not Germany, which is where I am right now, or any of our other allies.
So you would say right now, no compromise with Russia?
No, I think we could have a negotiation on arms control. I would encourage us to re-engage on that. And indeed, if we could find a a way out of the Ukraine mess, which leads to Russia to withdraw completely from Ukraine, to withdraw from Crimea, then one deal is that the sanctions that were imposed would be lifted. So there is much to talk about with the Russians, but it doesn't mean that you are trying to trade NATO or its membership for a dialogue with Russia. That's just not in the cards.
As you said, Ambassador Dalder, you're in Germany. What is the sense there? Is Chancellor Merkel on the same page with Macron about NATO, or does she see Putin in a different light from Macron?
I do think that the Germans have a very different view. One, NATO is a pillar of the foreign and security policy of Germany, has been for 70 years, will continue to be in the future. And she was quite clear that the kind of language that came from President Macron that talked about NATO being brain dead was unfortunate and something she didn't share. She also has, I think, a view of Putin as a wily character who is out there to undermine the unity of the alliance, who is affecting the security situation in Eastern Europe, and believes that NATO and NATO members, including Germany, including France, have a responsibility to counter that challenge by being clear that NATO stands united in the defense of its territory.
So with the 70th anniversary of NATO, what would you say is the value and purpose of the organization in 2019?
I think the value and purpose is what it has long been, to bring together a community of democracies, people who share key values and key interests with regard to how they defend themselves, to do so not only as a negative defensive force vis-a-vis the threats that it faces, but also as a positive force to bring stability and peace not only to the countries that are members of NATO, but to its immediate neighborhood.
Ivo Dalder, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That word, existential, it comes up again big time in our next story. Here's the world's Jessica Yarmosky.
It's almost the end of 2019, which means lexicographers are publishing their words of the year. And I have to warn you, none of them are particularly upbeat. Oxford Dictionary's word of the year is climate emergency. Collins Dictionary word of the year is climate strike. And today, Dictionary.com announced their word, which pretty much sums it up. Existential. Greta Thunberg's used it to refer to climate change.
So I just think we need to inform them and start treating this crisis like the existential emergency it is.
So has Joe Biden about, well, I'm sure you can guess.
The president is literally an existential threat to America.
Now, existential has a few definitions. It relates first to the existence of life, obviously. But the word is often used to describe a threat to that existence, as in an existential crisis. In their announcement today, Dictionary.com paid homage to one of the year's more appealing existential crises, especially if you're under the age of 12.
I am not a toy. I'm litter. Freedom!
This is Forky, the animated plastic spork in Toy Story 4. In the film, Forky battles through his own existential crisis after he's pulled from the trash.
Why do I have to be a toy?
Because you have Bonnie's name written on the bottom of your sticks.
Why do I have Bonnie's name written on the bottom of my sticks?
Dictionary.com says Forky's plight speaks to broader themes of existential threats that plagued humanity in 2019, which, yeah, is entirely depressing. But they also acknowledge the potential behind the word. And here's where Dictionary.com gets really deep. They say at the core of the word existential is the power for people to make meaningful choices about their own existence. That's a lot to put on a plastic utensil. Although by the end of the film, Forky's happy he's a toy. And it's a lot to put on people around the world who may have no real ability to make choices about their lives. But in the end, that's what the word of the year is designed to do. Crystallize one year into one word. Let's hope next year's word is a little less existential. For The World, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you have kids, you know how tough it is to find and afford quality childcare. When things fall through, working parents have a few bad options: miss work, cut back hours, or even quit their jobs. The problem is made worse by a childcare worker shortage here in the U.S. In Portland, Oregon, they're trying to deal with the shortage by addressing hurdles that are faced by many immigrants who are trying to enter the childcare workforce. The World's Marnette Federis has our story.
Lulos Claude is trying to get her kids ready for swimming lessons. I'm done working at 2, and then 4:15. I'm going to go switch to a meeting.
Claude explains her day schedule while her kids are jumping up and down and asking for sandwiches. It's a hustle to get them to their activities from school. But tonight, Claude will head to her own class at Mount Hood Community College in Portland. She usually stays up late doing homework for the class. But today...
I didn't do my homework today.
Wow, you didn't do your homework?
I didn't do all the homework. I don't know.
Because she got really tired.
I know. Always tired, right?
Always tired. Because she works 2 jobs. She's a substitute at a preschool and a caregiver for the elderly. Claude, who's 37, is originally from Haiti. She was a social worker there. When she and her family moved to the U.S. in 2017, she decided to shift into childcare.
Because I love children, and it's not like teach children how to write and read. No, it's teach them how to be ready for life, for the school, for the future.
There's a demand for people like Claude who want to work with kids, but the field is getting harder to survive in. There's a lot of turnover because the jobs don't pay much, ranging from about $11 to $20 an hour. Also, more skills and credentials are being required of workers.
What color do you want, miss?
So the night class that Claude goes to tries to give her a leg up, specifically a credential known as a CDA, for Child Development Associate. It's not required across the board, but you might need one to get a higher position at some childcare centers. Claude joins more than a dozen women and one man here twice a week. They're studying English for the CDA exam. There are also Saturday workshops to learn about child development. Tonight, the presentation is about children's songs and how singing in different languages can help kids who are just learning to talk.
You and you. Buenos dias,
comencemos. Mount Hood College has been tinkering with how to offer this training in a way that best serves people like Claude. Tuition costs and time can be big barriers. These classes are free, thanks to state funding. Carmen Ellis works with the Mount Hood program.
It's sort of like a ramp that you can get onto to take to get to where you want to go in your professional development.
Ellis also says professional development for immigrant workers is crucial. She stresses what many who study this field say. In the U.S., where young kids are increasingly diverse, it's a plus when teachers also come from different cultures. Right now, immigrants represent about 20% of the national childcare workforce. In states like California and New York, it's 40%. But immigrants can get stuck at lower-level childcare jobs instead of moving into leadership. This community college program wants to change that.
Fuerte, jala este fuerte. Ayuda.
Carmina Abrego is also in the class. She runs a childcare center from her home. She studied education in college in Mexico and speaks Spanish to the kids she cares for because she knows it stimulates the brain.
But if I tell them whatever in Spanish, they know what I mean, and they will do it to answer me. Like, for example, you want leche or agua? You say leche, agua. So, like, the brain is constantly working and thinking.
She used to be uncomfortable telling people she took care of children for a living. She felt people looked down on her. But since taking classes, she says she's proud of her work.
This is a very important job, and this is very serious. And that's too bad that people don't value it and don't appreciate it, how serious it is, right?
Now, Abrego wants to expand her business after she gets her credential. For Lulos Claude, she sees a certificate as a big first step to becoming a lead teacher in a classroom full of young children.
I'm sure I don't have that much in English to do whatever I want now, but I know inside of me I have the capacity to do whatever I want.
For The World, Marnette Fideres, Portland, Oregon.
We tend to think of the fall of the Berlin Wall as the end of the Cold War. But it was actually a summit 30 years ago today that officially ended the Cold War. Then-President-elect George H.W. Bush met with Mikhail Gorbachev, the head of the Soviet Union, in Malta. Michael Dobbs was the Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post and covered that historic meeting.
Gorbachev arrived in Malta for this summit that had been billed as the first meeting between him and this new American president. Bush would be on an American warship and Gorbachev would be on a Soviet warship, and they would alternately meet on each other's warships and symbolically bury the Cold War.
Down in Marcius Loch Bay, the warships, where the two most powerful men in the world, will be the guest of each other's navies. On the American side, the Belknap, flagship of the U.S. 6th Fleet, far outgunned by the Soviet cruiser, the Slava, means glory.
But they hadn't counted with the Maltese weather. This huge storm blew up and prevented them from meeting for the most part of a day. In fact, half their meetings were cancelled.
The world's most powerful leaders meeting off the coast of Malta to discuss the future of whole continents, and the setting was apocalyptic.
I remember seeing the expression on Gorbachev's face. Gorbachev was pacing up and down the ship, obviously, you know, intensely frustrated that he couldn't meet with Bush. From the American side, Bush wanted to develop a personal relationship with Gorbachev. He wanted to do what he could to facilitate the end of the Cold War.
But the freedoms that we seek must last for generations.
I think that Gorbachev had much bolder and more ambitious aims. He talked about creating a common European home in which the United States and the Soviet Union, after four decades of hostility, would really become partners.
Although we will be speaking on naval ships, I would like to assure you that we will be speaking about peace.
Bush overcame this cautious attitude that he had gone into the meeting with. He concluded finally that Gorbachev was for real, that there was going to be radical change in the Soviet Union, and also that Gorbachev was allowing all these remarkable developments to take place in Europe.
President Bush travelled straight to Brussels, ready to brief NATO about the end of the Cold War.
I am optimistic that as the West works patiently together and increasingly cooperates with the Soviet Union, we can realize a lasting peace and transform the East-West relationship to one of enduring cooperation. And that is
the whole of 1989 was the end of the Cold War. So the Malta summit really put the political seal on events that had already taken place.
Journalist Michael Dobbs there. He was remembering the summit 30 years ago today that officially ended the Cold War. Ukrainians say their war with Russia isn't just some regional skirmish. They say it's much, much bigger than that.
It's not just a conflict between Ukraine and Russia. It's a conflict between Western civilization and Russia, which wants to change the world order.
Why U.S. military support is vital for Ukrainians. That's still ahead here on The World. The impeachment inquiry resumes later this week in Washington. The central question, what was President Trump trying to do in Ukraine? For people in Ukraine, the hearings are a distraction. It's the war with Russia that most worries them. That's especially true for Ukrainian veterans coming back from the front lines. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports from the Ukrainian capital.
This 900-year-old monastery in central Kyiv is named after the Archangel Michael, the patron saint of warriors. St. Michael's monastery is impressive. Lots of gold, a beautiful bell tower, and pristine onion-shaped domes. But I'm not here to see the church. I've come to see a wall of photos displayed outside. They're portraits of Ukrainian soldiers killed in the war with Russia.
The photos fill this wall outside St. Michael's Cathedral, but it only goes until 2017 because literally they ran out of wall space.
Russia's war on Ukraine began in 2014. Since then, more than 13,000 people have been killed and many more injured. For many Ukrainians, Russia is seen as an existential threat. That's why thousands have volunteered for military service.
I go to a recruiting center and say that I'm the volunteer, I want to go to the front line.
I'm also a military veteran. I participated in the war against Russian aggression.
You know, a lot of my friends died at that war, so I decided, no, I cannot sit home and do nothing.
We'll get back to some of those voices a little bit later. Back at the wall of photos outside the church, I meet Taras Khmyut. He's a military veteran himself, and he was with the Ukrainian Marines when the war started. He says American military support has been vital since the start of the war.
In 2014, all the aid that was coming, the military rations, heat blankets, medical assistance, was all very important because we didn't have any. Not to mention, it was free.
But now, Taras says there are reasons for Ukrainians to doubt America's commitment to the war here.
It's because of Syria. Some people say what happened to the Kurds may happen to us next, so we shouldn't count on anyone.
He's referring to President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. forces from northeast Syria. On top of that, the administration temporarily withheld nearly $400 million in military aid for Ukraine. But Taras says that was a mistake, because it's in America's interest to support Ukraine.
It's not just a conflict between Ukraine and Russia. It's a conflict between Western civilization and Russia, which wants to change the world order. Every time we hear that sanctions could be lifted or eased, or our aid could be cut, it really demoralizes the people in this country.
In another part of the city, I visit another veteran.
My name is Leonid Ostaltsev. Now we're here in Kyiv on Safivska Street, number 8. It's Veterano Pizza. My pizzeria.
Veterano Pizza is run exclusively by veterans of the war in eastern Ukraine. Leonid also helps other vets start businesses of their own.
Every business is a story about someone who don't have anything, but he have experience and motivation to do something, and he just did it.
That must feel really rewarding.
Yeah, I love my work. It's my life, you know. I don't call it work because it's my lifestyle, you know.
Leonid comes from a military family. His father served in Afghanistan back in the Soviet days, but Leonid's military path was different. In 2014, after Ukraine was invaded by Russia, Leonid volunteered for the Ukrainian military, and in just 3 weeks, he was on the front line serving as a machine gunner. I asked him what that was like.
Some things you can't describe, because it's like, I don't know how it calls in English.
Goosebumps.
Goosebumps, yeah, goosebumps, yeah.
Goosebumps and flashbacks. They're not unusual for many veterans like Leonid. These memories don't go away. But for him, it's all about managing those memories and making sure to stay positive.
I can go sit and cry and remember everything that wasn't the war and drunk and do drugs, but what the fuck? I don't want to do this. I want to do something good. I want to show people that the veterans can do a good work. So it's only a question of choice. What choice are you doing?
Leonid has created a community for veterans, a place where people feel comfortable and help each other get their lives together. That's also the idea behind another organization in Kyiv. It's called Veteran Hub. Veteran Hub is a nonprofit that provides legal assistance, employment help, and psychological support. But it's also just a gathering place where vets can feel at home, including vets that are part of the LGBTQ community.
They even offer veterans a job. It's such a magnificent thing that a hub like this exists. It saves lives, actually.
That's Nick Buderatsky. He's a combat medic who works with LGBTQ veterans. He says Ukraine, and its military in particular, can be homophobic. In some cases, there's abuse and even violence.
There are guys who wanted to commit suicide even, yeah, because they thought that they are all alone and they don't have any support.
That's Viktor Pilipenko. He's also gay and a veteran.
Veteran Hub allows us to have meetings. We usually ask them for premises for our psychologist who works with the PTSD problems, and she also works with LGBT problems as well.
Victor says these services are crucial for LGBTQ veterans, who in some cases had never spoken openly about their sexual identity. Another combat vet, Vasil Davidenko, says he came out after his military service. He wanted to send a message to his fellow LGBTQ veterans.
Не бойтесь о себе сказать.
Don't worry. No one will touch you. The times are changing. We will help you. Look at me. I wasn't scared. Yeah, they beat me up. Yeah, they called me names. They spit on me. Whatever. You stand up. You brush yourself off, and you fight back stronger.
Vasil, Victor, and Nick are all strong advocates for gay veterans. They also have a strong sense of national pride. They signed up for service because Ukraine was attacked by Russia. They all appreciate U.S. support, and they hope America doesn't give up on helping Ukraine defend itself.
Our people are dying so that Americans don't have to. American soldiers aren't dying. Our soldiers are dying. Our regular people are dying so that yours don't have to.
Back at the Wall of Remembrance outside St. Michael's Monastery, Taras Khmyut and I take a stroll along the wall, looking at the photos. We're mostly silent until he stops and points out a couple of portraits to me. They're two sergeants who fought under his command.
I served with these guys here. This one, I personally convinced him to enlist.
It's not easy for Taras to tell me this. He's clearly proud of his service and he believes in Ukraine's cause, but the loss of life, the loss of fellow Marines, is something he carries with him.
What would you like Americans to know about this war, about the sacrifice of Ukrainians?
It's a difficult question. Maybe if the Western world were more active and wasn't scared of the decisions that it needs to make, this wall would have been much shorter, or it wouldn't have been here at all. Every day of inaction adds another photo or two.
For the world, Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
It's been a year of extreme weather events, dire reports from climate scientists, and major protests around the world demanding more action on climate change. And yet the emission of greenhouse gases that feed climate change keeps going up. This week, world leaders are gathering at the UN's annual climate conference in Madrid. Reporter Rachel Waldholtz is covering the event for The World. She says this is the last big meeting ahead of a 2020 deadline for countries to set new carbon-cutting goals and keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius.
These annual climate talks are sort of a chance for the world to pause and take stock of how we're doing on climate change. And the answer is not so great. You know, right now, if countries meet the commitments that they've made under the Paris Agreement, we're actually headed for 3 degrees Celsius. Many countries aren't even on track to meet those commitments. That's well over the target that the UN says is safe. And so this is a chance for countries to negotiate with each other, for NGOs and activists to step up. And there will be negotiations this year on some of the more technical aspects of the Paris Agreement. But really, the big picture is going to be happening on the sidelines, where countries are going to be trying to urge each other to increase their commitments.
Of course, President Trump does not support the Paris climate deal. Last month, his administration formally began the process of pulling out of the agreement. And yet today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is in Madrid leading a delegation of congressional Democrats, and they're sending exactly the opposite message.
By coming here, we want to say to everyone, we're still in. The United States is still in.
And in fact, Pelosi repeated that message several different times.
Again, coming from the Congress of the United States, we're still in.
So, Rachel, obviously Nancy Pelosi wants to drill in that point. The U.S. is still in the deal. What does that actually mean, though, coming from the Speaker of the House? Anything?
Well, on the one hand, no, it doesn't really mean anything, right? Democrats can pass bills in the House, but Nancy Pelosi cannot alone bring the U.S. back into the Paris Agreement. But on the other hand, these kind of statements actually do matter, even though they are symbolic. The U.S. is the world's largest economy. It's the second largest emitter after China, and so it has a huge role to play. And I really have heard from officials, from activists, that they take these statements from U.S. officials quite seriously. It makes them feel like the U.S. hasn't totally left the field and may in fact still return to the Paris Agreement. It's also worth mentioning that because of the way the Paris Agreement is structured, the U.S. is still in the agreement until November 4th, 2020, which is the first date that we can pull out. But that said, you know, there's no denying that there is an absence of U.S. leadership at the federal level, and that is certainly felt far and wide.
So what exactly will the delegates and negotiators in Madrid be discussing at this meeting?
So this year is a little bit of a sort of in-between year. So in 2015, you had the Paris Agreement itself was agreed. And then last year in Katowice, Poland, negotiators hammered out what was called the rule book. But there was sort of one big sticking point that was left over to this year, and that's the issue of carbon markets. So say I'm a country and I shut down all my coal plants, and I actually, not only do I meet my emissions targets, but I exceed them. That actually could generate a credit that I could could sell to a country that's struggling to meet its carbon targets. And that creates an economic incentive to cut emissions and perhaps cut emissions faster than you otherwise would. Mm. And experts say that if this is done well, this could be like a major engine for cutting emissions. But they say if you design it poorly, it could actually undermine the entire process. So that has been a sticking point in the past, and it's going to be a major point of negotiations this time.
Reporter Rachel Waldholtz is covering the UN Climate Conference for The World. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you, Marco.
We're a radio show, so on this front we're biased. We love sound. It turns out so do fish. That's the subject of a new study from a team of marine biologists in the UK and Australia. They looked at coral reefs that had been degraded by climate change, pollution, and storms, and they thought, what about putting some loudspeakers underwater to mimic the sound of a healthy reef? Maybe that would lure some fish back. Steve Simpson is a senior author of the study. People don't necessarily think of the ocean as being a loud place, but reefs, I guess, really are loud. We're hearing what a healthy reef would sound like. What are the kinds of sounds you can spot in this recording?
First of all, it sounds a bit like a heavy rainfall in the jungle or onto a tin roof, and that's the sound of snapping shrimps. And then on top of that, you've got all sorts of fish that can pop, they can grunt, they can gurgle, they can make whooping sounds.
How did it occur to you, Steve, that maybe sound would be a key component in revitalizing coral reefs?
20 years ago, we became interested in how on earth tiny fish that are maybe about 3 or 4 weeks old can find their way back from their first few weeks of development in the plankton to the right places. We obviously thought the ocean was silent. Jacques Cousteau told us about the silent world. But when you look at naval records, you realize that they have a real problem around coral reefs when they're trying to follow submarines because of what they describe as biological noise. So we started listening to this noise, and it turns out that it's all of the sounds we've just been hearing, these crackles, the fish sounds, the sounds obviously of whales and dolphins too.
And what have you noticed over the years about the noise level in coral reefs?
It's about a three quarters as quiet, because most of the animals that make noise are no longer there. It's lost its complexity, lost its diversity. The snaps of the snapping shrimp are far fewer. So you can hear that there's just so much of the soundscape that's missing from that recording. So we then started thinking, well, we've got these recordings of the healthy coral reefs from before the bleaching, before the cyclones. What would happen if we built some coral rubble into certain areas around on the sand and put our speakers next to them playing back these historic recordings? And really, to our amazement, we found that we were able to draw in the next generation, these baby fish, into the degraded habitats using sound. And the fish then settled there. They stayed there. And then what we really are excited by is that these are fish that will then start to speed up the recovery of degraded habitats.
But this reef sound enhancement business, it's not a silver bullet, is it? So what other strategies would it have to be paired with to repair reef ecosystems?
So in the long term, I think we need to be addressing climate change as priority number one. But in the shorter term, we need a toolkit, which are these immediate local actions. So soundscape enrichment is one of them. Obviously, fisheries management is key. Boat traffic noise. We've done a lot of work showing that actually human noise pollution can be really bad news for reefs. So if you can manage on the local scale, you then give those reefs a chance of being the ones that will help the rest of the coral reef environments to repopulate once climate change is more under control.
Steve Simpson, Professor of Marine Biology and Global Change at the University of Exeter. Steve, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chile is in crisis, affecting many, many people there. In a moment, we'll hear one woman struggle to get by in Santiago. It's been more than a month since Chileans took to the streets demanding a more just and equal society. In those protests, thousands of people have been injured, more than 20 killed, and there's been billions of dollars in damage. Protesters want affordable health care, education, and a livable wage. They're also condemning violence against women. A video of Chilean feminists dancing and chanting in the streets has gone viral. Spend a few seconds with it and you'll see why. The women wear black blindfolds. They repeat, "The fault was not mine, or where I was, or how I was dressed." Dozens of women then point their fingers in unison and say, "The rapist is you." They point to government buildings nearby and shout, "The state, the judges, it's the military, it's the president." The oppressive state, they chant, is a male rapist. These protests sit against that larger backdrop in Chile of inequality. For years, Chile has been one of the richest countries in Latin America. But compared with several dozen democratic nations, Chile is the most economically imbalanced. It's got the highest gender pay gap, and more than half of Chileans earn just $550 a month. From the capital, Santiago, Paige Sutherland tells a story of one woman trying to make a living wage.
Hola.
Cristina?
Cristina Espinosa lives with her oldest son in a modest house south of the city center. There are just a few rooms. Cristina shows me around, taking me to the kitchen, where she does most of her work.
Mi típico día. Yo me levanto a las 7 de la mañana.
Every day, I wake up at 7, and then I make popcorn and the Chilean sweet cuchufli, and I sell it in the street for hours.
After she prepares the sweet, she packs up her bags with the snacks and drinks and heads to her usual spot, a few streets away. She does this every day, even on the weekends. Cristina is 64. She says she thought by her age she'd be able to stop working so much. But her pension is only 130,000 pesos a month, about $160.
Baja, mi pensión es miserable. Es muy baja.
It's low. My pension is miserable. It's nothing.
And she says two-thirds of her pension goes to her medication for blood clots in her legs. It's not covered by the public health system, so she has to pay out of pocket. The condition makes it difficult for her to go out and sell every day, but she says she has no other option. She says when she was younger, she worked in stores, but making minimum wage wasn't enough to get by, especially raising three kids.
Soy una persona que trabajé y así eduqué a mis hijos en buenos colegios.
I worked very hard to send my children to good schools. In reality, all my money went to giving them a good education and to pay for the basics, like electricity and water.
All three of her children went to college, and she's very proud of that. They receive scholarships, but like most Chilean graduates these days, they have thousands of dollars of student debt.
El gobierno hizo que nuestro país fuéramos empresa.
The government made our country into a business. Education is a business. Healthcare is a business. This is awful, and it cannot continue in Chile.
That's why she's been participating in the protests. Cristina says the only solution is to change the constitution, which was drafted under the military dictatorship, to ensure that basic rights such as quality education, healthcare, and pensions are accessible to all. The government now says it will hold a referendum in April on a new constitution. Cristina says it will take time, but she has faith things will be different for her young granddaughter.
Tengo la esperanza de que tenga una buena educación gratuita.
I have hope that she will get a free quality education and be able to go to college like her mother, and that her goal won't be to afford a car or an apartment, but to have whatever career she wants.
In the meantime, Cristina will be out on the street, selling snacks to passersby. For The World, Paige Sutherland, Santiago, Chile.
It's versus it's. It drives me nuts. Get it right, people. Let's review, shall we? IT apostrophe S is a contraction of two words, it and is. It's snowing here in Boston. Throw in that apostrophe. It's no apostrophe signals a possessive. Example, the hotel was great. Its pool was amazing. No apostrophe. Pretty simple. I know, I need to get over it. It's not you, it's me, blah, blah, blah. Add that apostrophe there, people. I'm not going to give up on this. But after 18 years, the Apostrophe Protection Society is throwing in the towel. The society's founder says he has to accept that the English language is changing. My colleague Duncan Kennedy with the BBC has more.
They linger above our letters. They wander around the endings of our words. But apostrophes, it seems, are an endangered species. The Apostrophe Protection Society, yes, there really is one, says their future is, well, up in the air. The society's 96-year-old chairman, John Richards, says they're vital, Yet people have struggles with these squiggles.
If you wrote a note saying, I've come to collect my brother's books, where you put the apostrophe, before or after the S, shows you exactly whether you have one brother or several brothers. Can't think of any way around that.
Mr. Richards has agonised over apostrophes for nearly two decades, but now says, thanks to the likes of texting and Twitter, people have simply stopped using them.
I think it's a mixture of ignorance and laziness. They're too ignorant to know where it goes. They're too lazy to learn. So they just don't bother. The barbarians have won.
Mr. Richards says his society for this abused and misused punctuation mark is now closing, heralding what, for some, might be called an apostrophe catastrophe.
The barbarians have won. I'm guessing some of you are right now quoting that track from Vampire Weekend. You know the one about the Oxford comma and who really cares? That's where we leave things today. I know you heard that apostrophe. Don't tell me you didn't. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.